Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots. Tate Duryea and Ryan Gibson here for another week of financial education. Ryan, what's up, man?
Not much, Tate. Good to see you. Good to see us back and having another episode here in August of 2025. Where are we at in the market with real estate?
Yes.
Is it time to buy? Is it time to sell? Is it time to hold? We're going to dive into that today, which is exciting because I love talking about this stuff.
Me too. I'm an economic nerd. Inflation, interest rates, market cycles, occupancy, population growth, job growth, all these things, all the different data points that drive a real estate market. We're going to get into all of that. Today, we have Hunter Thompson. He's written a couple books. He has an amazing podcast called Cashflow Connections. He has interviewed economists. He's interviewed people from the IMF, just a student of economics and also a big player in the real estate space. He's also been a mentor of mine for about the last 7 years, and just excited to have him on the show. He's a wealth of knowledge.
Looking forward to talking about, you know, kind of where we are. You know, where are we? So if you're wondering, like, hey, is this a good time to buy real estate or invest as an LP? How do I evaluate one of those deals? This is an episode that you're not going to want to miss. So with that, let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
All right, let's hit it. Hunter, welcome to the show.
Honored to be on. Super excited for the conversation.
Yeah, we've known each other for, 7 years or something like that. And man, it's an honor to have you on. You're a wealth of knowledge.
I'm excited for this conversation. It's been awesome to see you guys grow this and turn it from something where, you know, when I launched my podcast, someone reached out to me, hey, did people actually listen to this? I'm like, yeah, dude, my uncle, my mom. And I'm sure the same was true for you guys. And now it's turned into this awesome machine. And I know how much hard work it is, but the results have been amazing. So it's super mutual.
It's been fun to bring to the pilot group. We're excited today to talk about all things market cycles, commercial real estate, inflation, interest rates, where we are in the big cycle. So, Hunter, you know, we gave a little bit in the intro about your background, but in your own words, tell us about your journey.
So when it comes to market cycles, I always have to, and I think I did a good job of this, is just being humble about the fact that I got started at probably the best time to get started in the industry's history. You know, 2010, I graduated college and basically was like, man, this is going to be easy because every article is like, there's this tailspin of foreclosures and it's all hell's breaking loose. Everyone's losing their job. And, you know, and I'm going to make fun of myself a lot during this interview, but basically I was like, what's everyone's problem? This is what every book said would be the opportunity you were talking about. Now, since then, I've learned a lot about this whole situation. But at the time, if you're a college graduate with no net worth to gain or lose, what do you care? Go all in. There's no opportunity cost anyway, and you didn't lose anything. So I didn't really understand that part of the equation, but I knew, hey, it isn't going to be like this forever. And if this turns around, it's going to create generational wealth. And so the first thing I did was tried to go all in when people were retreating. And I started attending networking events, which were very sad and somber, if I'm being honest. I mean, people were getting destroyed. People were having to pull their kids out of college because they couldn't afford it. People were downsizing. People were going through divorces because financial stuff pushed stress on people's families. But, you know, and I was aware of that. But at the same time, I was like, this is just a massive green light for someone that's trying to make a name for themselves. And that is kind of, it was very, very slow. And, you know, I got said no to a lot, but I did eventually figure it out. And, you know, since then I've been involved in, you know, billions of dollars of transactions indirectly because I used to partner with other operators, raising, you know, nine figures. And then in 2022, we transitioned our business to buy deals directly in Phoenix and just multifamily only in Phoenix, Arizona. And so that's kind of my background going from young, hey, I'm smarter than everyone, to like kind of seasoned person that's been in the business 15 years and has seen a true market cycle and now has uncovered, you know, what that means. And I'm happy to talk about everything along the way and also my outlook in the future.
What gave you the real estate bug to begin with?
It wasn't really the real estate bug. It was more that I was interested in the world of finance. And so I was like, okay, what is this world of finance? Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, you know, what are those lessons that we can learn? And so I read those books and was interested in those topics. And so as a college kid, this is before the boom of podcasts, but, you know, just watching CNBC every day and trying to figure out what this game is all about. And so what ended up happening is 2008 happened. And I was like, okay, that's extremely interesting. But it wasn't until 2010 that I started thinking about alternatives. And the reason for that is that 2010 was my last straw moment. And I don't hear enough people talk about this, but for me, it was like 2008 got my attention. 2010 was when the European debt crisis happened. And that to me was the holy crap. Like now, all of a sudden, I'm watching CNBC every day and we're talking about diversification and Apple versus Yahoo and Johnson & Johnson. And then none of that matters. And all of a sudden, the only data point anyone is talking about is the Greece bond yields. Are you kidding me? I could have never done enough research to predict that would be the single most important determining factor of my financial well-being. And that was when I was like, there's got to be a better way. There's no way to mitigate such a risk. There's got to be more simple investments that are more based on supply and demand and likely more predictable. And that's what sent me down the path to real estate. And it wasn't about real estate. It was just around real estate has a lot of good things going for it.
Hunter, you mentioned you were a capital allocator. Can you tell the audience what that means?
So, like I said, when I got started, you know, my first mentors were the people that made it through 2008, especially because I lived in California at the time. So, you know, California was decimated. So the only people that were attending those networking events to some degree were like people who were playing at a very high level, syndicators, people that were buying $15 to $50 million properties. And I saw the way those businesses were structured. And I went out to try to intern for some of these people, but they were like, we don't really have like manual labor jobs. Like you're not a skilled worker. So like, you're just going to waste our time. And no kidding, you want to work for us for free. We know why. So that wasn't my path. And so I figured out, well, first of all, I loved that. I was like, they don't have manual labor jobs in these companies because they're so scalable. You don't need a lot of like infrastructure like that. I was like, more green light, but how am I going to get in? And I uncovered that the thing that everyone wanted and couldn't get enough of was money, you know, especially at the time. And so I kind of uncovered that to short track all of the nonsense of, you know, going from wholesaling and fixing and flipping small houses that no one would want to live, you know, just going to that grind of a decade of that. I figured if I could find a way to show up on the doorstep with one of these operators with $500,000 or more, I'm going to get a legitimate seat at the table, if not just, let's say, meetings, which is really what I wanted to learn.
Yeah. How did you evaluate those operators to make a decision that it was worth taking other people's money and investing in that deal? And I'd love to hear what your criteria was for that, maybe in your first four or five deals, and how that's immensely changed, because I know you've gone through a cycle. And I remember working with you, I think it was about 8 or 9 years ago. And one of your, I remember a standout criteria was you only wanted to work with people who had gone through the 08 crisis. Or maybe I have that wrong. But you kind of wanted to only have people that had gone through kind of a down cycle, right? You didn't want to work with people who were just sort of catching the tailwinds of like the post great financial recession. Kind of talk through your philosophy, what it was like, what it is like, is what's really changed today?
Yeah. And I always try to be fair. And this is part of what it means to go through a cycle is that you kind of look back and things that you said. But like for full transparency, you know, if it was 8 years ago, you know, me saying you have to have gone through a cycle, it's a lot different than that today. Right. And so like if you're, it's 2012, you better gone through 2010 because, you know, it's been 18 months. So, but yeah, I'd say that, you know, looking back at it, the first thing I wanted to do is help my mom get money out of the stock market. That was like my number one goal. And so I helped her do that. I helped myself get money out of the stock market and start investing passively. And I really liked kind of low risk, cash flow focused plays, stabilized investments versus, let's say, development or more speculative things like that, or let's say fix and flips where there's not cash flow immediately. And at the time, at least from my perspective, the mobile home park business and the self-storage business were just like wildly outsized compared to everything else. That was just my perspective, right? And so I was looking for higher cap rates, predictable cash flow. I mean, at the time, you could see a 400 basis point delta.
And by the way, you were right. I mean, the cash flow on those two asset classes were insane post GFC.
It was difficult to get them financed, but it was basically a no-brainer. That was the reason I had so much confidence. I was like, listen, even if there's zero upside, if we're buying a 10% cap rate and we're borrowing money at 6%, I was like, there's just either A, I'm an idiot, or B, this isn't going to last. And it was B, it wasn't going to last, you know, because people are going to figure it out. But that was kind of what I was looking for. And then the other side of that, though, is that I was more interested in partnering with groups that were more senior and didn't really have this inclination to allow you to learn how to do it with my money. And so that lent me to work with larger groups. Now, there's challenges with larger groups. Maybe they're more busy. Maybe they're not as focused. Maybe they're not going to die over every single asset they own. But I was just more inclined towards that.
I want to pick that apart a little bit. Die over every asset they own. That's really important, I think, because bigger groups maybe have more, and maybe they don't pay as much of attention. Can you kind of elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, absolutely, because in some ways I'm living it now, because now since we pivoted in 2022, we're on the GP side. And so, you know, we know what it's like to where, I mean, I moved to Phoenix to pursue this initiative. My partner moved to Phoenix. My wife was 8 months pregnant with our second child when we decided to move, because we want to just, little portfolio just blowing into the urns, because you don't want to make a mistake. And so as a LP investor, you do want a balance of that, right? You do want a balance of that kind of intensity and focus and also seniority. And so whatever, that sounds like it's like perfectly set up for me and my business, but you get my point. It's a balancing act. You want to get sponsors at the right point of their growth, where they're not so senior that they don't care about answering investor questions or the fees are too high, but they also have this young, scrappy mentality.
You know, Hunter, on your show, you talk a lot about if you have to do something more than a couple of times in a year, get it outsourced, because that's how you scale it, right? You talk about, you know, the focus of, hey, I'm going to do this a couple of times. Moving to Phoenix and, you know, because you've made a decision to be a general partner, and this is the Passive Income Pilot show. People are thinking about passive investing and things like that. But I do want to kind of show what the other side is like, which you're doing a GP. That means you're an active participant. You're running these deals. And you have made the conscious decision to move to the market where you want to focus. And that doesn't sound scalable, right? Because you're kind of like, you know, you're blowing into the, you kind of gave that analogy of like, you're really like focused. But can you kind of give your philosophy there? Because that's, you know, I'll admit I've scaled my portfolio to 15 states. I can't live in 15 states. Kind of talk through that a little bit, because I know you're big on scaling and you're big on systems, and maybe kind of talk through how sometimes you maybe do the things that you don't, that don't scale, but it actually helps you scale much faster later. Is that kind of your approach to that? Or are you going to leave Phoenix, or what's your approach there?
Totally. I think that number one, Phoenix is a great place to live. So like in the next iteration of this, I don't think I'll be deciding where I live based on where we buy deals. But, you know, generally speaking, I felt like the intensity around the commitment to the initiative was really important for a lot of reasons. Many of them operational, some of them capital. I mean, capital loves to hear that, obviously. And so, yeah, of course, we have a vision that transcends Phoenix. But I think that when you are kind of going through that transition, it's just important to kind of show yourself and show your investors that you are committed. And I think, Ryan, what you've done is the example of a typical, you know, change of a normal operator as they go through their career. But just kind of going back to what I was saying at the beginning regarding mobile home parks and self-storage, like my original perspective and one that I want to share with everyone listening to this show in particular is that as an LP investor, you don't have to go all in. You can kind of play the game the way that an LP investor should play it. And I think it's a very prudent way to play the game.
Makes sense.
Hunter, I want to talk about market cycles and sort of the difference between what happened in COVID versus and where we are today and what happened in the great financial crisis. So for everybody listening, you know, the four phases of real estate typically starts with recovery after some sort of a downturn in the real estate cycle, and then expansion, and then hypersupply, and then recession, then the cycle repeats itself. Hunter, you want to talk about where we were and what that cycle looked like at the end of the GFC, the great financial crisis, and the run-up sort of to COVID, and then, of course, the external anomalies that were all of the money printing that were associated with that, and then sort of how we got here and where we are, and maybe how it differs from where we are in, say, 2010, where, you know, obviously real estate values are in a much different place, interest rates are in a much different place, Where are we in this big cycle?
Man, it's so crazy because you're right. Talking about it through the lens of, you know, during COVID and post COVID, because that's a multi-trillion dollar bomb that people don't bring up enough from my perspective. So essentially, when the COVID risk and the respective lockdown started, you started to get the sense of something. For people that have been in the industry for a while, there's all this talk about when's there going to be a recession? When's there going to be a correction? Especially in very competitive asset classes. I'm sure there was some discussion at Spartan, for example, when is there going to be a buying opportunity? And for those that haven't been through a cycle, what ends up happening is it comes and people will go, well, not like this. This is just insane. And that's exactly what COVID was like. It's like, well, that doesn't count. This is a historically significant, insane situation. That's what creates a 20 to 30% correction in a real estate asset class that people like. And so when that started to happen, which I thought we would have a correction like that in the wake of COVID, didn't happen the way I anticipated, but it still happened, which we'll talk about. But I braced for impact. And what really happened was that deal volume fell off a cliff. They hammered interest rates down and printed a lot of money. And so a lot of owner operators didn't feel any pain. And what I thought was going to happen didn't happen. There was basically just no transactions for around 6 months or so. Things started to come back and then things just ripped up and to the right, in part because of inflation in the wake of both money printing, low interest rates, but also a contraction of supply, which is the opposite of what you were just talking about, which creates a recession. Oversupply, overcapacity is what economists say is what creates a potential recession. We had the opposite of that. And then we had booming asset values, incredible price appreciation, meaning the price people pay for things, consumer price appreciation. And all of it incentivizes you to buy and invest. And that's exactly what happened. And then something that I did not predict, and I'm kind of embarrassed about it, but 4 years, and one of the benefits or challenges of running a podcast for as long as I've run one, is that you record yourself saying dumb stuff a lot. And so I looked at the chart of the interest rate of, let's say, the 10-year treasury. There's a 100-year chart that you can look at. And if you go pull it up, you'll learn a lot about the world of finance by just looking at the chart. And what you see is you basically see a 40-year decline down and to the right in the wake of the 80s. And I didn't see it changing anytime soon. And I was able to talk to economists, consultants of the IMF. I've been talking about this topic for quite some time, and including of the person who's credited with inventing commercial mortgage-backed securities. And all of us just looked at this chart and I was just like, they're going to smash interest rates down into negative, just like every other industrialized country. And that's going to be just so great for the world of finance. And then what happened is that because of the significance of money printing and the contracting supply and the impacts of globalization, which are very deflationary, you know, take a job that's 100 grand a year, outsource it to India for 15,000. It's very deflationary. That slowed. And then we get 9% plus inflation. And now the Fed raises rates faster than they raised them in 40 years, which now crunches anyone on floating rate debt. And that's the beginning of, you know, this other cycle. But that's kind of my perspective on why that happened, where I thought things were going to go and how it actually played out.
That's such a good explanation. I think one thing I just want to like pick out from there and make sure that people understand is that money printing isn't always a bad thing. You know, it's a really good thing that the government printed money and injected cash into the economy during COVID, because things would have been way worse. The problem is they overcorrected, right? That last $1.9 trillion they injected into the economy while all the factories were at full capacity. So if you're in a recession and, you know, half of your factory workers are out of work and you print money so that people can buy widgets and then that gets people back to work, that's not inflationary. But when you're up against the red line already and you throw more gas on the fire, now you've got even more dollars chasing goods that don't exist. And that's what caused the inflation, which caused then the knee-jerk reaction of the Fed to jack interest rates 5.5 points over 14 months. So, Hunter, do you want to talk about how that affects real estate? Because that really brings us to where we are today.
Yeah. So in the run-up to, let's say, 2019, 2020, 2021, the market had gotten very, very frothy. And so essentially, unless you had a ridiculously low cost of capital, like you were a family office with a 6% cost of capital or something, you know, you essentially had to use floating rate debt if you were to buy, let's say, multifamily. And
what's a family office for anybody that doesn't know?
So family office is a term that gets thrown around. It's basically, think about it like this. When you make and have enough money, the mistakes you can make could be corrected by an employee. So let's say, like, this is a silly example, but like one time I remembered we had an unexpected tax gain at the last minute and tried to offset it and missed the deadline by a little bit and cost us like 50 grand. So what I really could, and this is a small situation, but well, I could have paid someone 50 grand to be like, make sure I don't make this one mistake, and we'd have been net even. And so that's the concept of a family office, just with millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions and billions. Is that basically, as you start to play the game bigger and bigger, the economics make sense that you can basically pay people to keep you out of trouble and keep you optimized because pennies become dollars and thousands and tens of thousands. I think that's a silly explanation, but that is my vision of like how this should go. And really what that means is that everyone listening to this should be thinking like they are a family office, because you are. You should be paying to make sure you don't make mistakes, even if it's just a CPA and an attorney. Later, it could be director of acquisitions just for you and your portfolio. And that's kind of like the vision.
Excellent. Thank you.
Hunter, you mentioned looking at a graph of interest rates over 100 years and starting high and kind of going down all the way until a certain point of 2022. I remember you debating on stage if interest rates will rise. And what side of the argument were you on that? I can't remember.
I don't remember either. No, I'm just kidding. So this is one of the problems with like doing this for so long. So I was heavily on the side of interest rates going lower.
Right, lower for longer.
And I think you were actually like picked to be on that side and you had to defend it. So I don't think you actually chose to go to that side, if I remember right. But
that your memory is just as good as mine, but I'm pretty sure I was, because I really did believe it. So much data, and not like I'm not an economist. I just am like interested in the topic. But really what I saw was generally, forget the economic situation, the way the political incentives are set up, it's always incentivized to be inflationary, to keep interest rates low so that you can at least pass the bag to the next political leader so that you don't face the pain. And so when I saw that 40-year trajectory, that's what I saw continuing. It wasn't just, you know, silliness or whatever, but that's part of it, as well as the fact that all the EU countries and such have lower interest rates in America, despite the fact that America is the global reserve currency. None of this stuff makes sense to me, but that is exactly what happened.
Well, and by the way, I was on your side, just based on data, right? And so then you mentioned, you know, kind of through the cycle, you know, we have this steepness, right, where we've never seen interest rates. We've seen interest rates at 5.5 or higher, but we've never seen them rise, overrun so quickly in such a short suspense. And we've had economists on the show that have talked about how that was more the issue of what created the situation that we're in today with real estate, more than underlying fundamentals. Can you kind of talk about if you agree with that, or do you think we have an underlying real estate fundamental problem? And then sort of share like what you think that means for the future. Because I mean, I'm reading on the TV that, you know, interest rates are supposed to go down 100 basis points potentially by the end of the year. But then Jerome Powell seems uninterested in any rate cuts, it seems. But Jerome Powell also waited too long to raise the interest rates, right? And so we're, you know, kind of looking back in hindsight. So is he going to wait too long to lower them? What are the impacts? What do you kind of see going forward from that?
So a couple things. I mean, one thing is that I think you'll probably be sympathetic to this. I really try not to read the headlines, and I try to find where the market is on these topics and just kind of assume, okay, listen, that's the best kind of guess that I can come up with, is just the people buying and trading. And so, for example, if you want to know like my perspective on the future of the federal funds rate, you know, the federal funds rate has a futures market where people basically make bets on the futures of the federal funds rate. So if you Google Chatham Financial forward-looking curves, you can pull up a chart that shows the federal funds rate, the 5-year treasury, the 10-year treasury. You can see this stuff out. It's kind of similar to where it's like—
Right, the Harry curve?
Or the SOFR curve, or, you know, there's different curves out there. But like if you're going into an election year, for example, I mean, from my perspective, my best assumption of who would win an election is not based on polls. It's based on like betting sites. That's just what I personally believe. So, you know, I think that the federal funds rate will go down and to the right, probably by 100 basis points. I think the 5-year treasury will follow suit, but the market anticipates that the treasury will actually increase as we get into 2030. So, you know, this is not just my perspective. This is just basically, you know, billions and sometimes trillions of dollars trading hands, making those kinds of bets. And then people have reasons for why they think that's the case or why they think that's not the case.
Yeah. And getting back to like fundamentals, right? Was the interest rate spike over the time period sort of the issue, or is there an underlying problem? You know, you hear syndicators or operators trying to sell you on real estate deals. There's a housing shortage. And then you hear other people say there's not a housing shortage. And then I hear overbuilding in this market and underbuilding in that market and affordability issues. And so like, where do you kind of stand on all that?
Well, the reality is kind of what I was talking about was that in most competitive markets, you essentially had to use floating rate debt, unless you had just a ridiculously low cost of capital. And so you could either sit on your hands starting in 2018, or you could be a normal entrepreneur and try to find a way to participate in the market intelligently. And so most people did that, right? That doesn't mean everyone did. I know great groups that didn't, but most people did. And so what ended up happening is that when the Fed raises rates faster than they've raised them in 40 years, you get into a situation where your debt costs so much more than you could have possibly anticipated from a sensitivity analysis, that it's just, there's no end in sight, realistically. And I've run all kinds of studies where, like, let's say you're using 70% loan to value or 80%, which is common at the time as well. If you go from 3.5% interest to 7% interest, it doesn't matter if you're the best operator in the world. There's just no viable path for you getting back on track unless you infuse the property with cash or buy additional interest rate cap, and I can go on and on. That's why there's been distress. And yes, there has been building, but this is like marginal. Like rent reductions of 3% don't crush a deal. That's why we like these deals. You get crushed when your cost of debt doubles.
Right. We've seen this in the commercial real estate market where, like you said, it doesn't matter how well you operate a property. When your cost of debt doubles, you can't outrun that. And so that brings us to the environment that we're in today. And, you know, Ryan, I love your question about like, are we overbuilt? Are we not overbuilt? You know, Phoenix is a market where it got real built up. The Phoenix market is experiencing something like 10% vacancy with negative organic rent growth. However, a bunch of these developers are getting crushed because of the vacancy rates, because they overbuilt. And we're kind of turning a corner where we're seeing some positive organic rent growth now, some potential lowering of interest rates into the fourth quarter of 2025 here, which obviously is shaping up to, you know, what looks like some really nice tailwinds for commercial real estate versus the headwinds that they've experienced over the last few years. So coming back to that big real estate cycle, you know, we have an advisor on our board who has been in the real estate business for 40 years. He actually built a software company that Spartan uses and has built real estate and LIHTC, self-storage and LIHTC and all sorts of stuff. And he was a big investor in 2022. It just goes to show that, you know, nobody was expecting rates to rise by 5.5%. But he said on a call the other day that I was on with him, it was the end of a 7 or 15 year real estate cycle. And I should have seen it. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think it was the end of a cycle, or do you think that it was a black swan event? And where are we today?
Well, that's kind of like what I was going back and saying regarding COVID. Like, imagine, because we can all remember that we're just like, when is there going to be a correction? When is there going to be a correction? And then it happens, and it's in the form of this like pandemic with all these lockdowns. And you're like, right. Well, come on, that's not what I meant. It's the same thing when interest rates rise faster than they've risen in forever or whatever. It's like, well, geez, that doesn't count. It's like, that's what this is all about. The subprime mortgage, who could have seen that come? That's the whole point. You got to be prepared for this stuff emotionally, financially, all those things. But here's the interesting thing about this one is that I was around in 2010. I wasn't around in 2005, but I was around in 2010. And there's a big difference between 2010 and now. What happened now is that the underlying fundamentals were strong and are strong. 5% occupancy, the difference between 95 and 90, is just not going to make or break these deals. It's just not true. And the reason people are developing in markets like Phoenix, which is not just Phoenix, it's many of the booming markets in the country, is because they're booming. Population growth, job growth, people are flying in from all over the country and working remote and going to these amazing places in Florida and Texas and you name it, North Carolina, South Carolina. But you've got massive distress in booming markets. But the distress is not because of the fundamentals, it's because of the financials. It's entirely financial distress for the seller, meaning that you could buy a property that is 90% occupied from a seller who's got their hair on fire. That is historically significant. I believe that's a buying opportunity of a generation. That just doesn't come around that often. And that's why I'm so bullish that we decided to make the moves that we have.
Yeah. And when you mean by 90% occupied, but hair on fire, you're basically saying that operator is running a solid business, a well-occupied property, but their underlying debt might be so expensive that they can't cover their payments. And so is that kind of where you're going with that?
That's exactly right. And the extra benefit or challenge, would, depending on how you look at it, is that in these markets that are booming, they will do anything to keep these properties because all the information I'm talking about is publicly available. It's not some unique algorithm that Tyler, my partner, and I figured out. It's, hey, population growth, supply and demand disequilibrium. And so a would-be seller is like, can we just hold on for one more year? One more year. Just, we're going to be okay. Maybe two more years. Like, borrow some money from somebody and let us keep the deal for 24 more months. But see, even in those cases, still some slip through the cracks. And that's why you see something really interesting that I've read about and I even saw in 2010, but I didn't experience it from the business owner perspective. As a college graduate, when transaction volume goes down by 80%, what do you care? You got no expenses. You don't have kids. It doesn't matter to you. You can wait. But as a business owner who's now in the game and you've got employees, when you see transaction volume go down by 80%, as you know, you basically make money in this game buying and selling deals. So when you see that plummet, if you had a goal of a company of buying four deals in a year, that would mean that you'd buy a half a deal in a year. And so what's that? That's nothing. And so, you know, basically that's what happened at ASIM Capital and many other firms around there, is that you were stretched, your patience, that competitiveness, that excitement about the discounts, but you were only going to get the deal that slipped through the crack and slipped through the crack and slipped through the crack. But you get some incredible deals buying when no one's buying and selling.
When you say, you know, I want to unpack that, because for people who are simply an LP in a few deals, they're seeing deals come across their desk, they might not grok how difficult a market it is right now to find deals, because it's a great time to buy, but nobody's selling. So, and we're not talking about residential. Residential is actually a different anomaly, a different beast, because residential real estate has actually gone up and to the right over the last few years because it's been supply constrained, because everybody locked into these, you know, 2.5% interest rates. Different story. We have not seen much of a drawdown in valuations on the residential side. And there's actually quite a bit of supply now. People are finally starting to sell. Commercial real estate is a different beast. You know, we've seen a drawdown because of the rise in interest rates. Commercial real estate trades on a multiple of income. And that multiple has expanded because people are willing to pay less for the same cash flow stream because their debt costs are higher. So what that means is that commercial real estate as a whole has come down since the rise in interest rates in valuation for a $100,000 cash flow stream. The value of that $100,000 cash flow stream vis-a-vis the real estate has come down by 30-ish% across the board just because of the debt costs. So what Hunter is saying here is that it's a really great time to buy because you're buying at these cyclical lows and at a time where we're seeing, you know, the forecasts of interest rates coming down, which form tailwinds, yet it's difficult to find deals because nobody wants to sell. So the only people that are selling are the people that have to sell or that have some life event that is causing them to dispose of assets.
100%. And that to me is rare, because in 2008, you know, you go tour a property, you're like, great, we would buy it at this basis. It's 40% the cost it would have been 3 years ago. Cool. Well, I can't get a loan because right. No one will loan me. And then you get into the Uber didn't exist at the time. You get into a taxi and that guy used to make 180 grand a year. And like, that was what was going on in the entire economy. It was this real tailspin of the economy. That's not what's going on in the economy now. It's the only people that care are me and you, and right? That's it. And but that's good. That's good from a capital allocation standpoint. We are ready. There is dry powder. And thanks to programs like yours, you know, there's this really hungry, excited, and now knowledgeable LP base that is like, this is the time. And if you've got that attitude, dude, I am sympathetic to that. And go all in, depending on where you are in your growth. If this is the first podcast you've ever heard, God bless. Can you imagine this being the first? I'm sorry that it was me. But go all in on education first, learn the ropes, find out who you identify with on a gut feel perspective and from a strategy perspective. But if you are a competent and confident investor, this is, you are right. Your eyes are not deceiving you. This is that big opportunity.
Yeah.
Love it.
And so getting back to that night, I want to highlight the opportunity a little bit more and kind of drill down one level. So 90% hair on fire, you're buying that deal at lower than what he bought that deal because you're going to buy that and have a higher interest rate than of yesteryear, right? So kind of talk about that. So like maybe, I don't know, is there a statistic where maybe a deal made sense at 3.5%, but for every 100 basis points, you're going to take off so much of the purchase price to make that financial engineering work? Because I do think that's really important. Is
definitely,
you know, you get these deals and you're an LP and you're looking at them and you're like, okay, I just listened to Hunter talk about this deal is 90% occupied, but the seller's selling. Why the heck is the seller selling? Oh, the seller had floating rate debt, then it went up, and then he got over his skis, and now he's forced to sell. So what am I looking for as what makes that a good opportunity or not? You know, the market's still good. I mean, obviously he's well occupied.
I mean, there's a couple metrics that can cut through the noise really quickly that most LP, because I think your LPs probably know all the normal stuff, but let's talk about some stuff they probably aren't thinking about. I think the one thing that'll give you a good clue into where you are in the cycle is just looking at the debt. The debt that is used to acquire bread and butter deals, whatever that is, and more specifically, the debt that is needed to use to acquire bread and butter deals will tell you exactly where you are in the cycle. Meaning that if you can buy assets in a prime booming market with fixed 5-year financing, you are not at the peak of a cycle. Now, that's just, no. It's not possible, but it will not last. And so, like I said, you're either dumb or it won't last. And so in that case, I know for a fact that it won't last. How long? I don't know. I'm not a market timing specialist, but I know for sure that what will happen, think about it. It's not that everyone's an idiot. It's that what ends up happening is that you start to see robust rent growth. You start to see more job growth. Then you start selling assets and getting insane returns. And you're like, we're going to do more of this. And so what happens is people are willing to pay more for the same assets and the same cash flow. That's how you see cap rate compression go down. But again, it's not that they're dumb. It's that now you can implement a more aggressive business plan. You can actually see, listen, the property next door is nowhere near as nice as this property, and it's renting for $400 a month more, and all we got to do is put $20,000 per unit. Let's just do the same thing. I'll give you one better than that. Hey, there is 200 units in this property. 40 of them have already been converted and are already renting for $400 more than the others. Can't we just do the rest? And then you start to do it. And when the market gets really frothy, you do 40 and someone tries to pay $3 million more. And you go, okay, I won't even do the rest. I'll just sell it to the next guy. The next guy goes, now there's 80 units that have been rented. How much more proof do we need? And so it goes and it goes and it goes until something changes with the debt. Until the bank says no, until the bank gets burned, I mean banks, but also the banks generally, the banking sector, and they go, stop, party's over. And then all of a sudden, 2008, all of a sudden, 2022. That's how all these cycles work. It's all about the debt. That's why the debt is how you know where you are in the cycle.
So good.
In what terms would you see? So, okay, we're buying a deal and it's fixed rate debt. What kind of leverage would throw a red flag in your mind?
Well, that's the thing. Because if it was 5 years ago, I can come and just do this dance about red flags, you know, rules of thumb and such. But let me give an example. I will answer your question directly, but I'm trying to be humble in my approach here, because if I could give this knowledge to an LP investor that you will go on a journey that will make you understand why there is and will always be market cycles, I would feel like I did a good job here. Does that make sense? Because I could say—
Yeah, totally. I think that's, you know, a recession is not, you know, something you go to a doctor for and they prescribe a specific medication. All recessions are built different. They all happen at different points and different times for different reasons, and a different lever got pulled. It's not like you go, okay, it's a recession. What medication do I need this time to fix it?
Or like it's time for one.
Yeah, or it's time right. for one. Exactly. Like you go in and it's a different reason every time. It's Black Monday of the, you know, it's the .com bust. It's the GFC. It's the COVID, it's whatever it is, right? And it's always different. And so it's a matter of just kind of, you know, reading the clues and the tea leaves to the extent that you can, and kind of knowing, okay, well, we're through it now and we're kind of on our way to the next thing, right? So it's in positioning yourself to have enough liquidity and reserves and, you know, backup, right? And as pilots, we know this because, you know, everything's going great until it's not. And we're usually one of the first industries that gets hit, because when you have a recession, then everybody says, well, we're not traveling to those conferences anymore. We're not going to this business meeting anymore. Everything is
not going on the vacation anymore.
Yeah, we're cutting vacation. And so it comes to a grinding halt. And then the airlines, you know, they always say the economy sneezes and the airlines catch a cold. And then all of a sudden you're on furlough. And you went from what can happen to me to holy cow, I'm getting a furlough notice next month. You know, I thought we were hiring 10,000 people as an industry this year, and now we're cutting down to nothing. So it's definitely something that, you know, as pilots, we have to keep in the back of our minds, right? Just as real estate investors, it's the same approach. It's like, everything's going great. Don't redline what you're doing, because just a little bit of a hiccup can mean that. And I think that's really the takeaway as an LP is, when you look at the deal, let's stress test this thing a little bit and see what happens if we go a little bit left and a little bit right. But unfortunately, these pro formas usually just tell you nothing but up and to the right. They're telling you, oh yeah, this deal's we're gonna grow rents at X percent per year, and the market, you know, is gonna go up, and we got a nice tailwind, right?
I think that what Hunter is saying is, you know, you said liquidity and reserves, and really that means airspeed and altitude. So if you lose an engine, you have options. You know, what you don't want to be doing is flying right at stall speed, right above the ground, because then you have no margin for error, and you have no way to get out if something goes wrong. So
can I interrupt? Because this is coming from a non-pilot. This is where it gets so confusing. Imagine a situation where you got this buddy that's just always flying low, and that he gets there faster. I don't know enough about flying, but he gets there faster, didn't use enough gas. And so, hey, bro, that guy gets a raise. Then the next year he gets a raise. Then his three buddies start doing it. He gets a raise. Then we're 7 years in, and everybody that's doing that is getting raises. They're getting promoted. They started their own plane company, and he's a billionaire now. That's what a market cycle sounds like. And eventually you go, dude, my first mentors were wrong, bro. They were telling me 20,000 feet, this guy's doing 1,500, and look at him, no problems for years and years. And eventually those rules of thumb start to change. And so
that's the $10 fares. We see that in aviation. It's like, you know, it's about to go bad when an airline pops up and has $10 fares. You're like, oh, here we go again. Yeah, you know, and it's a startup, you know, Skybus or, you know, Independence Air, what, you know, that air, you know, it's like, oh, here we go again. Here we go again.
That's so funny. Well, can I say one thing about the
reason?
Because I want to give you some, because it's important to know, but like, just know that the real rules of thumb that you actually should follow is that you're probably not smarter than everyone, and that you really should be capable of making it a couple of years without transacting. And so I certainly fell for both of these. At the beginning of the podcast, I talked about, is everyone dumb? Buy low, dummies. It turns out you might be getting squeezed. You might be going through a liquidity crisis. You might be going through a divorce. These are the things that happen when things actually turn around, and they turn around more pronounced ways than people imagine. You know, a rule of thumb for me in 2010 was, I'll never invest in a deal unless it produces 10% cash flow year one. Okay, cool, rule of thumb. How are you going to lose money doing that? Great. Except for it doesn't work in 2 years, goes away. So you have to adjust. Okay, it's 8%. Okay, it's 5%. And so you got to be very careful about these things. So just always follow the main rule, which is that you may be able to have a market advantage, but it's not that everyone else is stupid and you're just got it all figured out. So as we look at where we are in the cycle and like where things start to get uncomfortable, you know, I would just say there's a material difference in floating rate versus fixed rate debt, a material difference in likelihood of capital calls and return of capital. It is like they're in different worlds. Another difference is long-term debt versus short-term debt. The difference between a 3-year business plan and a 5-year business plan is material. And usually those two things go together, meaning that if you have a business plan that is a 3-year business plan, you also take floating rate debt. And now you're starting to stack the deck against the favor of you returning your capital.
Yeah. And for anybody that doesn't, that isn't familiar with commercial real estate, they're like, what do you mean 3-year business plan? Who cares? It's a 30-year mortgage, right? No, not in commercial real estate. You know, you have a balloon payment. It's a 3-year or 5-year where you have to pay off that note or refinance. And in commercial real estate, you can't just get a 30-year note and then pay it off in 3 years. There's draconian prepay penalties. So your debt has to be right-sized for the expected timeline of the deal. And that's where people get in trouble, is they take on five-year debt and the interest rates go up and it's coming up on that five-year mark. And that loan has to be either repaid or refinanced at the end of that. There's no other option. So you either have to sell the deal at potentially a loss or refinance into this crazy high interest rate. And so that's what Hunter's talking about in terms of longer debt, like pushing off that balloon payment, you know, the brick wall there, so that you're not forced to sell at an inopportune time. And I think that's so important, because if you have a long enough time horizon in real estate, it's very hard to lose.
Yeah. When I look at a deal, I say, how long is the projection? The longer the projection, the better the deal, in my opinion. This is just my opinion, subject to change. If you give me a deal that's short term, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year deal, I'm dubious immediately, because so many things have to happen within that period of time to produce the returns. And it might be a 20% annual return or something for 3 years. But what if it turns into a 6 year or 7 year deal? Now, all of a sudden, that 20% per year is now getting cut in half, right? So now you're taking on risk. So every short-term deal I've been in as a passive investor has been either missed the mark on overall returns or has extended many, many years beyond the target date, every single one. And so I personally, people say, why is this a 6 year hold, or why is this a, you know, I say that this is better. Like, if you can actually achieve, if you can flex this deal that long and actually make that amount of money per year, that shows you the strength of the deal. And you can really, you're widening the aperture on how, when you can exit based on market cycles as well. If you're going 3 years, that's a very short window to make your shot. And so I think that's what people do, is like, when the deal can't work, they just ratchet down the number of years, and then it amplifies the return to make it look better.
Right. Because the same equity multiple in a shorter time period is a higher average annualized return.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I get a little bit skittish on the short-term nature of deals and the confidence people have in actually achieving that, especially in commercial real estate. A flip, I get it. You know, a flip is get in there, buy the house, flip it, you know, maybe a year time frame or 18 months. That's different, though. We're not talking about that. We're talking about like multifamily, self-storage, mobile home parks, et cetera, where it's kind of a longer cycle.
Hunter, you've been in this business a long time. You got over 1,000 podcast episodes. You've talked to economists and you know, you had incredible guests on your show. What gets you excited? What gets you out of bed in the morning, you know, in August 2025?
Well, on the personal side of things, I have a 3-month-old. So hey. I also have a 2-year-old, but like, that's kind of where I'm at in life. So these are kind of like the diapers and the things. And what is this 2-year-old going to say? He's so funny and looks exactly like me. Thankfully, my younger son looks exactly like my wife. So we have our little mini-me's. I also really like working out. I'm training for something called Hyrox. Maybe you've seen it post up on Instagram. It's cool. Check it out. But in terms of business, you know, I love this industry. Generally speaking, it's a perfect suit for my personality, because it's complicated enough and it's lucrative enough, but you can also be a normal person and really compete with the business school guys and the Harvard guys. And I like that. I like that good mix. And I'm sure everyone I'm speaking to right now is kind of familiar with that. Like, you want to be in the room where people are making a lot of money in the room. Right. And maybe you're not the smartest guy in the room, but if you were allowed in the room, it's like you got a shot. And that's kind of how I want to play the game, where I don't want to have to be like some quant in Manhattan slaving away on some algorithm. I want to work with people and create partnerships. And this industry is just so well suited for that. And if you're listening to this and you're kind of sympathetic to that, you know, I started in this game as an LP and just liked the people. It's like, I want to build a career around these people and these strategies. And that is still what gets me up. And, you know, if I had an extra comma in my bank account, you know, I would be doing this interview right now.
Yeah. I feel the same way about flying. If I had an extra comma in my bank account, I'd still be flying. I say all the time that, you know, I got 2 of the best jobs in the world.
I love that.
So Hunter, thank you so much for coming onto the show. How do listeners tune into your podcast? I've really enjoyed it over the years.
So yeah, we talked a lot about it, and it's really the foundation of what I kind of learned. And you can just check it out, Cashflow Connections on Spotify, iTunes, et cetera.
Thank you so much, Hunter, for coming on, sharing your wisdom. Been very informative and fun to see you.
You too, guys. Thanks again.
See ya.